Okay, so this is actually work done by two outstanding young collaborators of mine mostly. Roberto Dienar, who's a postdoc in my group and is actually looking for a position, and Radhdeep Sen Sharma, who is going to move to Harvard in fall. I have a starting student, Bill Schneider, who has done some of the work. And in part of the work, Jason has been a collaborator in other parts. We have just discussed vigorously, as you can imagine, with Jason around. Okay, so there are various routes to attaining strongly interacting Fermi systems and cold atoms. And I'm going to actually only discuss one in this talk, and that's to use a Feshbach resonance that's just by hand enhance the interaction so that scattering length diverges, and then you can access the phenomenon of BCS-BEC crossover. But of course, there are other routes that experimentalists are also taking. One is to put the system in an optical lattice where you suppress the kinetic energy, and then the repulsion can become much larger than the bandwidth. And at least one of the big goals in that game is to realize a 2D Hubbard model and understand something about high-TC superconductivity. Actually, that's where I spent most of the last 10 years working, so it's kind of surprising I'm talking about this. But in the last few months, I've been focusing quite a bit on cold atoms. Finally, you could also rotate a system, and like the quantum Hall effect, you can go into the lowest Landau level, quench the kinetic energy, again, the system becomes strongly interacting. So there are a multiplicity of routes. This list is probably not exhaustive to strongly interacting systems, and I'm just going to talk about the BCS-BEC crossover here. So I'll give a very short introduction, partly because I feel there have been lots of talks discussing this so far in this workshop. And then I'll break my talk up into three parts. In the first part, I'll tell you about vortices, core states, and critical velocity. In the second part, polarized fermions and traps. And in the third part, quantum fluctuations in the superfluid state. And as I go along, I'll tell you what my specific theoretical and experimental motivations for looking at these various questions were. So this is my one-line introduction to BCS-BEC crossover, that there's a scattering length, which in a model you can just change by changing the attractive interaction in a two-body potential. In a real experiment, you tune by changing a magnetic field. And when the scattering length is very large, you are sitting right here at this most interesting regime called unitarity. When the scattering length 1 over KFAS is negative infinity, you get a very weak attraction relative to the Fermi energy. And so you finally just end up with a weakly interacting BCS Fermi superfluid, and with the size of the pairs is huge compared to the interparticle spacing. And in the opposite limit, where the 1 over KFAS goes to positive infinity, the attractive interaction is very strong, which forms tightly bound molecular bosons. But once that interaction is taken care of, the residual interaction between these degrees of freedom is very weak. So again, you land up in a weakly interacting Bose superfluid regime, where the size of the molecules is much less than the interparticle spacing. And this is one of the most interesting regimes, where the scattering length diverges. You have a genuinely very strongly interacting Fermi superfluid, and you have universality in the sense that there's only one length scale, KF inverse, one energy scale, epsilon Fermi, AS, the scattering length itself, drops out of the problem. And this is just, I think to this audience, I don't need to tell you that there have been a variety of experiments by at least these six groups, perhaps now even more, using Fermi atoms, lithium-6 and potassium-40. What I will be calling the up and down fermions are actually two different hyperfine states, but I will just use the solid-state physics terminology of calling them up and down. And the pairing between these spin-up and spin-down fermions is tuned by changing the two-body interaction between these through a Feshbach resonance. And as is now well understood, when you have a wide resonance, the width of the resonance much larger than the Fermi energy, then basically you can just deal with the problem as a single channel model characterized by a single parameter, the scattering length. Here are some typical numbers in the experiments. So As I already told you, the unitary Fermi gas is the most strongly interacting Fermi superfluid that we know of. The question is there any physical observable that shows dramatic behavior at unitarity? I mean, what is the manifestation of this very strong interaction? Now, of course, since this is a crossover, obviously there's no singularity, and so the definition of the word dramatic is in some sense subjective. I mean, universality itself is in some ways dramatic. But I would like to see some physical observable that, you know, shows a dramatic peak or a dramatic minimum or something like that, which tells me here is a characteristic of a very strongly interacting system. And it wasn't obvious what such a quantity is. So for instance, if you look at the transition temperature, the transition temperature rises and possibly shows a weak maximum, but basically plateaus out at some number of order 0.2 epsilon Fermi. So from this point of view, the unitary superfluid is not particularly important. And in fact, when I say possibly shows a weak maximum, I think there's an important point to emphasize here, that any analytical calculation of this TC, like, you know, saddle point plus Gaussian, at the end of the day, you have to remember that if you look at the correlation lens in the problem, and you have to be careful what you mean by that, as you go from BCS to BEC, the size of the pairs, which is this dashed line as a function of 1 over KFAS, is monotonically decreasing. However, the correlation length, which here I denote by psi GL, which is the prefactor of the Ginzburg-Landau coherence length, which is going to diverge, the entire Ginzburg-Landau coherence length is going to diverge at TC, that prefactor actually has a very non-monotonic dependence. And you sort of understand why. In the BCS regime, it's exponentially large. But in the dilute molecular Bose regime, it's power law large again, because a dilute Bose gas actually has a long correlation length, a long healing length, okay? And it goes through a minimum, which is precisely of order KF inverse, as it must at unitarity. And that tells you that the Ginzburg region, precisely here, is basically of order unity, and no analytical calculation will be really controlled insofar as a computation of TC is concerned. Okay, the Ginzburg region is exponentially small here, power law small there. Eric, yes?
Explain again what Xi pair and Xi GL are.
Okay, so Xi pair is, you look at the internal pair wave function and look at its RMS value. So it's the size of the bound state, and that's monotonically decreasing. Xi GL that I've written down here is that near any finite temperature phase transition, there is a correlation length which is going to diverge, and that has where in mean field theory the exponent nu is 1/2. And so it's this prefactor. And in BCS theory, this prefactor is exponentially large compared to the interparticle spacing, which is why mean field theory is so spectacularly good in the extreme BCS limit. In the extreme Bose limit, again, this is not exponentially large, but this is power law large. But here, okay, this is the old famous Ginzburg criterion, you know, KF times CGL is for the unity, and I don't think you should trust or even debate questions about little bumps in analytic calculations.
So if you take the BCS limit and you go beyond the BCS calculation to
right.
include the collective modes,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't generate any new length scales. You just get left with
that's
the
right.
bearing size. And
that's right.
Collective.
So actually,
kind of placed, because on the right hand side, really, you're grafting on some other.
So actually, such calculations have been done. And some of them were done long ago, and some newer ones at zero temperature I'll report in a second. But all I want to say is that there may be something very interesting related to pairing pseudo gaps, but that's not the topic of this talk of mine, so I'm not going to discuss that. Yes,
sorry,
sure.
Just one more question. The difference between T star and TC is the same mechanism for giving rise to that.
So I didn't say anything. So here. T star is something like a pair formation scale. Okay, it goes from the BCS scale out in the BCS limit, actually to Saha ionization. So you can actually analytically show that over here, T star goes like the binding energy divided by the logarithm of the binding energy divided by the Fermi energy. And that comes from the following physics. So this is in the BEC limit. About T star, okay, the system can be essentially described as free fermions. The temperature scale above which the molecular BEC will look like free fermions will be set by the binding energy of the pairs. But the entropy of pairs also comes in and lowers that temperature scale. And this is the logarithm that comes from the Sackler-Tatrode equation, which is the entropy of classical gases. And you can just get this out of a functional integral formulation. So this is where it's free Fermi-like. Below it, pairs begin to form, but it's only at TC that pairs condense. But I'm not, that wasn't the topic of this talk at all. Okay, yes, Eric.
Your analytic calculation of the B limit CGL, or is that?
Yes, it's an analytic calculation. Okay, so the way you do it is,
precisely known coefficient of that?
There are precisely known coefficients, and there is a precisely known error in those numerical coefficients also. In the following sense, that the, again, I'm talking about the BEC limit. There is some precisely known coefficient that you can always get out of any textbook, okay? Because this is a known result, where N is the boson density, and B is the boson scattering length, okay?
Is that where that 0.6 comes in?
That's right. So the analytic calculation here, this is one way the 0.6 comes in. Here, in this kind of a theory, which gives you an analytic result everywhere, AB turns out to be 2AS rather than 0.6AS. But then maybe you can try and improve on that, okay? But this is an analytic.
Can you repeat that again about the 2 and the 0.6?
Sorry?
Can you repeat what you just said about the 2 and the 0.6?
Okay, what I said was that this kind of a theory will give you AB to be 2AS, okay? But in reality, AB is equal to 0.6AS.
When you say this kind of theory, it's really an incorrect calculation.
Well, it's a many-body calculation.
But it's a wrong, I mean.
So it, see, look, the point is this comes from solving a four-body problem exactly. And then the question is how to embed that four-body problem within a many-body problem. And Victor and others have made progress on that precisely in the BC limit. But the virtue of this calculation is it works everywhere, okay? But you shouldn't trust it for numbers like 2 versus 0.6. You should trust it for trends.
So the real answer that the coefficient has not been calculated?
So the coefficient has been calculated at the level of mean field plus Gaussian, and the coefficient is wrong in that you get a 2 instead of a 0.6AS.
It's more accurate where you say the coefficient has been calculated incorrectly.
if you see, the question is, we don't know of how to embed the 0.6 in a many-body theory that works everywhere. I think that's a fair statement. So you take your pick. Either you do a many-body theory that embeds the exact four-body calculation correctly in this extreme limit and be happy with that correct answer, or you do a many-body theory which gets the whole thing qualitatively right at the expense of not getting this two right. Yeah.
Set this by Eric, so we have a debate among Ohio people here. Eric is incorrect in a strict sense.
Yeah.
However, you'll soon see this incorrect theory, the power of this incorrect theory, that is quite enormous.
You should not trust it for numbers like this if that was your goal in life. But I think it's a fair statement that we actually do not know how to embed that, the physics of 0.6AS, I mean, how that changes as you push away here and to get a complete theory that gets all of that right. except by doing perhaps quantum Monte Carlo. But even that's not very clear if that's been done. Okay, so now, here, that was introduction. Okay, so now, so you probably people have forgotten, here was my motivation. Is there any physical observable that shows a dramatic result? And so we decided to look at the structure of a vortex. Because if the healing length is going to do something dramatic, non-monotonic, maybe there are some interesting things. And we found one interesting result on fermionic core states, but we actually found that the critical velocity shows a very dramatic behavior at unitarity, and that's what I want to tell you about. Okay, so here are vortices in a rotating Fermi gas. People have seen what seem to be quantized vortices, which is the signature of superfluidity. And so how might we study the structure of a vortex? Well, in order to have a vortex, you need an order parameter which varies in space because there's a phase winding as you go around the center of the vortex, and that's the e to the I theta. And then at the center of the vortex, the order parameter must vanish. And so the goal of such a calculation is to see precisely how the order parameter and the density vary in the presence of a vortex, and what kind of fermionic excitations might they support in the core of the vortex. So, yes?
So how well do you think the Bogliubov-Dejean
theory So the Bogliubov-Dejean theory is an extension of the kind of theory that I was talking about at zero temperature to spatially varying situations. Okay? And so it'll capture, for instance, in the BEC limit, it'll give you the Gross-Pietaevsky equation. Okay?
So it's in the same sense.
It's in the same sense. That's right. That's right. Okay. So the first thing you learn is, well, maybe I should just skip this. But yeah, let's just skip this. So you can calculate order parameters. You see how they change as a function of 1 over KFS. You can calculate densities. You can see how in the BEC limit, the density is only very slightly depleted. In fact, in the extreme BEC limit, not at all depleted at the center of the core. It, as you go towards, I said it backwards. In the BCS limit, the density is not at all depleted in the center of the core, even though the order parameter is suppressed. But in the BEC regime, basically, the order parameter and the density are very closely related quantities, and so the density itself is also hugely suppressed, and you can see how vortices might be much easier to imagine the BEC regime. But here is the part which I find the most interesting. So when you solve this problem, you can also look at the current flow around a vortex, and the reason why the current flow as a function of radial distance from the center of the vortex has this non-monotonic behavior is very easy to see. The superfluid velocity, being the gradient of the phase, just goes like 1 over r in the theta direction. And so to get a finite kinetic energy of superflow near the origin, basically you can argue that J must go linearly in r. But at very large distances, where the superfluid density is the full density n, J must go like 1 over r. So in transiting from a linear behavior to 1 over r behavior, it shows a peak. And the peak is probably the best way to determine the size of the vortex. And the peak value of the current is actually a way to determine the critical velocity, because it's as if the current was flowing, and then you decided that, aha, I've hit critical velocity, and now I must make the order parameter collapse, because I can't take it any longer. And so here is the size of the vortex core. This is a zero temperature Bogliubov-Dejean calculation. And this is the Ginzburg-Landau calculation that I told you about. Okay, there are two length scales which are at least qualitatively similar. One was calculated near TC. The other one is calculated from a completely different calculation at zero temperature. And you can see that indeed the core size does show this non-monotonic behavior. But the most interesting thing is that if you look at the critical velocity from the peak in the current flow as a function of 1 over KFAS, then it shows a dramatic peak at unitarity where there's only one scale in the problem, VF. And so you get a number, which is 0.22 times VF. Okay, and I remind you that unlike TC, which had this weak maximum that you couldn't really talk about much, this has a very pronounced maximum. And now let's try to understand, why does this calculation see this very pronounced maximum? Why is the unitary superfluid the most robust superfluid in the entire crossover? Because basically this is saying, if I push on this superfluid, the unitary superfluid will remain superfluid up to a very large velocity, much larger than on either side of that. And this can be very easily also seen from the Landau criterion from the critical velocity, okay, which is a quite different calculation, okay, which is there in all the textbooks. You try to move a particle and ask for when it spews out excitations and becomes unstable and makes the superflow unstable. And so you have to look at the minimum of the excitation spectrum divided by K to get VC. That's Landau's old story. And so as a function of 1 over KFAS, what you find is, if you limit yourself to pair-breaking excitations, single-particle excitations, then, of course, the gap is increasing as you go from BCS to BEC. And so this turns out to be the minimum of the Bogle-Bau quasi-particle energy divided by K, as shown here. But on the other hand, there are other excitations in the system, the collective modes. And the collective modes have a velocity which just goes from VF divided by square root of 3 in three dimensions at the BCS regime. And then the collective modes become soft as the molecular boson becomes more and more dilute. And the way in which they become soft is, again, as shown here, square root KFAS. And again, here, in the calculation of the velocity, the coefficient will be the 2 instead of the 0.6, at least at this stage of the development. But you will see that that won't change the fact that there's a softening. So there's a difference between the way in which superflow is destroyed on the BCS side, that's by pair breaking, whereas on the BEC side, there's no Roatan minimum here like in helium. So the critical velocity just happens to be the speed of sound. Okay? And so the critical velocity is given, must be below the red curve. It's the minimum of the red and the blue curve. And you can see again from this argument that there must be a peak, or very likely a peak, at unitarity. Okay? So
they cross exactly.
Well, I wouldn't trust that because of numbers. Okay? But, I mean, there's nothing singular at unitarity anyway. So maybe it happens in the vicinity of unitarity. I wouldn't bet my life on where exactly it happens. Okay? But this is a very different calculation from this calculation, and both of them give the same non-monotonic result. So I feel this is an experimentally testable statement that this very strongly interacting superfluid is the most strong, is actually the most robust in the entire crossover. Okay, fermionic bound states in the core, there is a long history to this. Karoly, Dejean, and Matrikov predicted them in 64. They had to wait for many, many years, 35 years before their prediction, 25 years, sorry, before their prediction was verified in the lab. But the point is that if you have an order parameter that varies in space, then, of course, you have the continuum of states above the bulk value of the gap. But inside the core, you have a series of closely spaced fermionic bound states. Because the order parameter is going to zero, you can have much lower energy fermionic excitations inside the core than in the bulk of the system. And in fact, Karoly, Dejean, and Matrikov showed that the minimum gap is not delta naught in the BCS limit, but rather an exponentially smaller quantity, delta naught square over epsilon Fermi. And they also showed that the spacing between them also went as delta naught squared over epsilon Fermi. And one quick way to understand why you might get a scale of delta naught squared over epsilon Fermi is to realize that if I have a potential, even though this is in the off-diagonal channel, which has the scale of the coherence length, the correlation length C, then the binding energy is h bar square over mc squared. And so the deep bound states in that, h bar square over mc squared is precisely delta naught square over epsilon Fermi. So one of the questions was, what happens to this as you push through towards unitarity. And what you find is that rather remarkably, yes?
Can I just ask a question? I mean, one can understand why there should be some sort of continuity in thinking about the ground state and its body of the gen as you go across, and one can probably isolate which feature doesn't capture the BEC side.
Yeah.
With the familiar excitations, is there a bit of a distinction there? Purely because on the BEC side, how you think about familiar
so we will come to that. So that we will come to that. So see, one of the things you might have said was what Bugliobau Dejean can capture well the fermionic excitation, but it should know nothing about the collective modes, right? The Bugliobau Dejean. But look. This, which was sort of a collective mode phenomena, is also captured in the Bugliobau Dejean theory. So I think we don't quite know why it's as rich as it is, but it can capture things. So in the presence, see, those are the collective excitations in a bulk system, but now here you are doing a mean field calculation, but in a system with a spatially varying order parameter. So somehow it knows about these collective excitations. I would never have guessed that if you had asked me.
Yeah.
But there it is.
No, sure. It was somehow more the fermionic thing.
Okay, so in the fermionic, I will address your point, precisely the point that you raised. What is the fate of these in the BEC regime? So the
isn't it the same answer as when there are derivations using Bugliobau Dejean for the things but on the BEC side? So I think to the extent that I can derive that, then I would be able to capture some collective mode.
I think you're right. But you see, if you really wanted to capture a collective mode, you would have to do a time-dependent version of the Bugliobau Dejean. But somehow, even the static version of the Bugliobau Dejean captures a bit of physics that is best understood in terms of collective effects. Okay. So here, if you look at the minimum gap, okay, the mini gap as it's called, it continues to look like delta square over 2 epsilon Fermi all the way past unitarity. And I think it's basically because of the 1 over m psi c squared argument that I was giving you. Okay, that's a very robust argument for bound states. This size is c, and therefore that's the energy. But now we find a very peculiar result that even after the chemical potential has become negative, which is the molecular BEC regime, and this comes to your question, we still find a bound state, which I would never have expected to be there at all. Okay? And this bound state is very peculiar for reasons that I will explain in a second, but it's very clearly a bound state. It's split off from the continuum, and it has an exponentially localized wave function. So it has all the characteristics of a bound state. Now, naively, what one would have assumed was that if I have a potential like this, which is going to bind the state, then the binding energy should be less than the value of the potential at infinity. That would have been my picture. This bound state is not sitting in here. This bound state is sitting up there. Okay? But when you think about it carefully, you realize that this is the only place where it can sit if it sits anywhere. And the reason for that is that the continuum in this regime where the chemical potential is negative starts at absolute value of mu square plus delta naught square. I assume people know this. This is a old result, but anyway, there it is. And if somebody doesn't, I'd be happy to explain why the continuum starts not at delta, but rather at the square root of mu square plus delta square. In the absence of any order parameter, the continuum of fermionic excitations would have started at absolute value of mu. Okay? And the bound states sits in between, peeled off from the new continuum, but clearly above where the old continuum states was, which is the only place where it can be. And also, I don't want to get into it, but I understand precisely what the fate of this is now as you go into the extreme BEC regime, where both of these pinch off, because delta will become much smaller than mu, so the separation between them pinches off, and there is a point at which the bound state disappears. Okay?
Okay.
But But there is...
So the limit of it being very dilute, so if mu goes to zero, then this...
Mu here is actually not going to zero. Mu is rather going to, in the BEC limit, mu is going to minus 1/2 the binding energy.
So that was the wrong question. Maybe I can ask a slightly different one. In the limit where it's very dilute,
yeah.
What you might think you'd want to recover is the scattering of a fermion off one of these composites.
Yes.
So it's a kind of three-body.
So if you actually go into that dilute limit, there is no bound state. Though I didn't show you that. This bound state, calculation for this bound state was done at 1 over KFAS equals plus 1. You want me to go to 1 over KFAS of 1,000 or something like that.
Yeah, I think what I was meaning also was, can one trust the Bogliubov-Dejean in that?
So as I again said, in that limit, the Bogliubov-Dejean reduces to Gross-Pitayevsky. Zero temperature, Bogliubov-Dejean reduces to Gross-Pitayevsky. And so to the extent you trust Gross-Pitayevsky for dilute bosons, you should trust this. But there are no fermionic states there. Okay, I mean, there are, but they are at very, very high end. I mean, they are like, there are no bound states at the core of a boson, of the extreme bosonic vortex.
Okay, all I'm saying is that I guess I'm just worried about using the Bogliubov-Dejean argument to establish there's no bound states. Because that seems to rely on using that approximation of the domain where one might not trust.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. It might be an angels and pinheads question.
Okay. I don't know the answer to that question posed that way. Because I can do what I can do, and I know that it goes away in that limit. Before you hit that, there's a critical value of the scattering length as you go to 1 over KFAS, beyond which this doesn't happen. So it just looks like an empty bosonic Gross-Pitayevsky vortex.
Yeah, in principle, there are also some continuum states that run in the core, the ones that have zero barrier, the ones that have zero angular momentum centrifugal barrier, and their particular L values, but they're very small, and they've never been seen experimentally. They're the order of the quantum depletion parameter.
This is in the BEC limit.
Yes. If you just take the Bogliubov equations around the Gross-Pitayevsky equation,
okay,
you do get some states in the continuum,
okay,
that have a finite value at the center. It's like S states.
Okay.
But are those
scattering states.
They're bosonic.
Yeah,
so you could think of them presuming that what's out of this is something like bound pairs.
Yeah, but that's oscillations of the vortex lines or something.
I guess they're not in the Bogliubov.
They are not. These are not in the Bogliubov-Dejean theory of the kind I'm talking about. Eric.
What is the critical value? What is your estimate of the critical value?
Okay, I don't have a number on the top of my head right now, but I can show you what the argument is. I don't.
Is it 1 or 10 or 100 or
1,000? So actually, I have not put in the numbers. I have just, in fact, only last week with Jora, we figured out how to find that. So we just wrote down the equations and said, yeah, but I haven't actually completed the calculation. So it's not, that statement is not even in the published paper. Okay. So let's just end this part because we are very, very short of time. Yeah.
Oh, we have short time.
Yeah.
Well, this question keep coming up several times. I don't know whether the one you ask question satisfied. But I think there seems to be two questions. One is that whether this Bogliubov Dejean is good at all.
Yes.
Secondly, is that if good at all, in what sense? I think the one who asked question has not really specified. The second question is, if you read Bogliubov Dejean, whether this fermionic bound state, which is a new feature here, not in the boson, is real. And I think, in my opinion, that this bound state is real, and the reason it exists in the bosonic psi is because that it just tells you that this boson now has a composite nature.
That's right.
So in the usual the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, one just does not see this bound state. But then the question is that whether I should trust this Bogdanov Bohr degen to be good at all. Then I guess one have to ask, good in what sense? I mean, whether it one's model with the equals it, one knows the fact that at finite temperature, then the Beanfield theory in the simplest version may not be good. One has to go to Moser Schmidt when that time many of all these things, and which may even not satisfy Eric and Breton. I think the point is that the Moser Schmidt will only, I mean, the complication of that procedure only appear when you adjust the chemical potential, but the gap in the left or gap equation is like very much BCS like. So I think the high the fluctuation may only control what this chemical potential is, but when you fix the chemical potential, you still have this kind of.
But I'm not sure that's a true statement at zero temperature. If you go if you look at fluctuations around the mean field theory, I believe both the gap and the chemical potential make a equally important contribution. But if you go near TC, you're right. The fluctuation contribution to the number equation is qualitatively important, whereas the fluctuation contribution to the gap equation may only be quantitatively important. I agree with that statement.
And at the moment, I think how to incorporate this fluctuation in the BDG equation is not...
is not known, actually. That's correct. So, I mean, to even answer questions like how good is this, so what can you do better to test? One thing you can test is against experiments, but I don't know what else you can do which is better, at least within theory, to test this. Okay, so now I want to change gears completely and talk about a very different situation, unitary superfluids with spin imbalance. And here I want to talk about the non-trivial effects of the harmonic trap. Okay, so I think I shouldn't call it the local density approximation in Kohn Hall because, you know, with Walter Kohn involved, those words have a 40-year-long history, but unfortunately that's what people call it in the cold atom community. But I think it's probably safe to call it the Thomas Fermi approximation. Okay, and there are two messages that I want you to take from this. One is that the breakdown of the Thomas Fermi approximation will be particularly important when there are competing phases. And I think actually this has a very long-term message for this field because people are trying to make more and more complicated Hamiltonians and so on, and they are likely to have lots of competing phases, and therefore doing a simple bulk calculation and patching it up using Thomas Fermi can be a very dangerous game to play, okay, as I will show you. In this specific context, but I think this has rather long-term implications for the field. The other thing, which is probably more interesting to people who are really looking at the preprint server every day in this field, is that there is a lively debate of why there are great differences, apparently, between the MIT experiments of the Ketterly group and the Rice experiments of the Hewlett group when they look at unitary superfluids with spin imbalance. And I think we have a qualitative understanding of the differences in the trap parameters and the number of particles that gives rise to the observed differences. Okay, so the Thomas Fermi approximation is basically saying that the properties at any point R are those of a uniform gas, but with a density which is equal to the local N of R. So if you want to use this, you first solve the uniform problem. And a lot of people have actually worked on solving the uniform problem with population imbalance when N up is not equal to N down. And after that, you simply use a Thomas Fermi-like replacement that the chemical potential becomes spatially dependent. So you replace it by mu minus the potential. And that then leads to order parameter variations and density variations. Now, these are very hard to measure in the experiments, but these are apparently much easier to measure in the experiment. And so at least within this approximation, the density as any point in R would just be some, perhaps non-trivial, but nevertheless a function of mu minus V of R. As a result, contours of equal density, the density itself, should just follow equipotential contours. And that's something that the experimentalist can measure very clearly. Is this true or is this not true? And in the experiments...
contours are the magnitude of magnetic fields?
No, the trapping potential. This V of R is the external harmonic potential. Okay, so wherever that comes from. Okay, it could be a magnetic field, could be magneto-optic trap, whatever. But whatever the potential V of R is, N of R should just be a function of V of R, should just be a function of the V of R and not of R itself. Okay, so if you look at the experiments, you find that in the MIT experiments, the densities really rather look elliptical following the contours of equipotential. So it looks like Thomas Fermi is a very good description of the MIT experiments, whereas here you can see that in the Rice group, the pictures don't at all look like ellipses. They look completely flattened and so on. Okay, so it's as if the densities are not following Thomas Fermi theory or the equipotential contours. So why is that? And of course, there have been debates back and forth, and most people have come out on the side of saying, these guys say they are wrong, they say they are wrong, and so on. Okay, but I think actually both of them are right. It's just that they are working in rather different parameters.
What's the major difference between?
Yeah, so here is the major difference. Yeah, so let's look at the potential. It's axially symmetric. Okay, there's a trapping frequency omega not along the radial direction, and there is the Z frequency, which is much shallower than the radial frequency. And the amount by which it's shallower is the is alpha. Okay, so if you look at the trap anisotropy, you see that the MIT anisotropy is about a fifth, and the Rice anisotropy is about a 50th. Okay, so there's a factor of 10 difference there, which wasn't so obvious in the pictures because they are just drawn with a certain aspect ratio. If you look at the number of particles also, the MIT traps have 10 to the 7 particle, the Rice traps have 10 to the 5 particles. Okay, Thomas Fermi seems to be good here, at least insofar as the equipotential contours are concerned, and not so good insofar as the equipotential contours are concerned. The question is, how is the validity of Thomas Fermi affected by trap anisotropy and number of particles?
Yeah. In MIT, they find this is a large region of partially polarized.
Actually, that's not so true. I have now looked very carefully, and MIT has reversed some of its, but we can discuss that. Yeah. So that's right, because in the large region, the halo that they were finding was in a rotation experiment that they were doing along the SIGAR, and they were showing you Z integrated densities. But now when they actually show you the real densities, they don't seem to find such a large region. But anyway, we can discuss that.
Okay. Look, the reason I mention it is that I think still my recollection that they still find about my from Martin just a couple of weeks, they still find a reasonable
but at least different
region there.
But yeah. So we come to that, Jason. Yeah? We'll discuss that as well. So again, since all of you already love Bogle-Bourdieu so much, and it's the best thing that we can do, okay? That's what I'll do. It is the simplest theory beyond patching up a bulk theory using Thomas Fermi approximation, and which allows for spatially varying order parameters and densities, so you can solve them, and okay? Now, the difference is I'll show you some numerical results, and I'll actually have lots of analytic stuff I won't show you. The difference from previous studies by the Thurma and Machida groups is that they've always looked at isotropic 2D or 3D traps. And I think the distinction between Rice and MIT has much to do with the anisotropies of the trap. Okay, so that's what I'm going to focus on. So here is the kind of picture you get. Okay, so here, say, along the Z direction, on the axis R equals 0, this is what the order parameter does. Okay. And this is what the magnetization, which is the spin-up density minus the spin-down density, does. So this is for a trap anisotropy of half, up spins 1,000 particles, polarization of 30%, zero temperature, scattering length of infinity. Now, if I had done a simple Thomas Fermi, what I would have said is that there is a central core, which is an unpolarized superfluid. N up equals M down, therefore the magnetization is zero. Superfluid, therefore the delta is non-zero. Outside, I have a wing, which is a fully polarized normal fluid. Delta is zero, so there's no superfluidity. And there's magnetization. And actually, what I'm not showing you here is that N down is actually zero here. So it's a fully polarized normal fluid. In the Thomas Fermi approximation, there's a very narrow regime where you might get a partially polarized normal region between them, I would not call it a phase, but a region, transition region, going from the unpolarized superfluid to the fully polarized normal fluid. Okay?
What does narrow mean? What are you comparing with what?
Okay, so I'm comparing it with the Thomas Fermi radii of the clouds, and I can give you actually at least within Thomas Fermi analytical answers for what that number comes out to be. Okay? And there is no FFLO to talk about in the bulk calculation at unitarity zero temperature. However, the Thomas Fermi then has a jump discontinuity in the order parameter profile, which of course is very bad from the point of view of gradient energies. So the question is, when you allow for anything to happen, the system introduces an FFLO-like region in this here, okay, as a transition between the unpolarized superfluid and the fully polarized normal fluid. So a state which would not have survived, just a second, in the bulk, because Q squared times delta squared, the kinetic energy of making the order parameter oscillate all over space, would have just made it energetically prohibitive, features of it show up here. Yes, Eric?
What do you mean by FFL?
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes. So there is a history going back, I don't know, 40 or 50 years. Fulde and Ferrell and Larkin and Ovchinnikov, they looked at polarized superfluids in the extreme BCS limit and said that in the phase diagram between the unpolarized superfluid and the fully polarized normal system, there is a region where the order parameter actually oscillates. And the oscillations of the order parameter have a length scale which have to do with the mismatch of the Fermi wave vectors of the up and the down spins. Okay? So
what you're seeing there is 1.5 oscillations.
What we are seeing is absolutely 1.5 oscillations. Okay? But and in a numerical calculation, if you see that, you have to check. Is this depend on cutoff? How does this depend on number of particles? And what is the magnitude of these things? And what you find is that all the tests you do, it passes the test, namely that this is a real effect. And actually, you can, instead of working in a complicated trap, you can solve a simple one-dimensional problem where you can do much more, much larger numerics with much larger cutoffs. And you again find that in the one-dimensional calculation, if you put a boundary condition here, which is like this and that, in between, you will see oscillations. And the scale of the oscillations is determined by delta Kf inverse in space. Yes?
Well, I was asking a question. In the same way as your interesting plots about the order parameter and the density for a vortex as you went across unitarity,
right,
is there not also an issue with FFLO?
Yes, there is. Or and I have not. And so what I. So
does the density uniform?
So I don't know the answer to that question. Okay, I haven't done that calculation. Okay, but it can be done. The point, all I'm saying is that here is a transition region which is not described by a stable phase in the bulk for these values of the parameters, which just appears. Okay, this is some more comparisons. But let us look at what that tells you about the magnetization. So here's the magnetization, okay? M of R, Z, N up minus N down. And you can just see visually whether this follows curves of constant equipotentials or not. And what you see very clearly is as you elongate the trap, keeping all other parameters the same, the Thomas Fermi approximation as viewed just by looking at the densities, not even by looking at the order parameter, is clearly violated. Okay? It's not following curves of constant. Otherwise, you would have seen full ellipses here. Okay? So an increasing violation of Thomas Fermi. Yes.
Explain what the picture is showing.
Okay. So the picture is showing the following. This is the R direction, the radial direction, the vertical direction. This is the Z direction, the axial direction. Okay? The picture is a false color plot of M of R, Z, where M is N up minus N down. Okay? And the scale for this is shown here. Okay? So what this is showing is that in an anisotropic trap, the magnetization preferentially goes towards the Z edges and is not formed along the R edges of the cloud. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
So if you have any system that likes to separate, you would say that's a, you would call that a violation of Thomas Fermi?
No, this is not a system that's separating. It's whether the densities follow curves of constant potential. So curves of constant N or M in this case, are they following contours of constant V of R? That's what I'm looking for. I'm asking you, I know what the ellipse here is. I could have drawn the ellipses here. But I mean, it's obvious that it's not following an ellipse. That's all. Okay? And actually, the experimentalists like to plot column integrated magnetization, where this looks even worse. I mean, the violation looks even worse. Although this is something we are getting rid of information in doing this. But that's something that the experimentalists can do very easily. So you can see this doesn't look at, and this shows you all those square regions that the rice people saw, basically. Okay, on the other hand, that was as a function of increasing anisotropy. But suppose I fix the anisotropy and change the number of particles. That's all I do, fill more and more particles. Then you expect, actually, that Thomas Fermi should be restored, and indeed it is. Okay, so as I go from 250 to 562 to 1,000 particles, this begins to follow more and more the contours of constant V of R. So,
can you understand that?
Yes.
I mean, no, I was going to say, it seems to me that the psi presumably decreases as you increase N. And so if psi gets very small, then the local density approximation ought to be better and better.
No, actually, I think it's the wrong way. Generally, you know, even for bosons and so on, when N increases, the local density approximation becomes better. And here is the argument. Okay, so here's a scaling argument for the validity of this as a function of trap anisotropy. What you want to see is that this transition region L, if it's tiny compared to the radius of the minority cloud, then basically Thomas Fermi is a good description. And so you can see how the Thomas Fermi cloud scales with N and alpha. And you can see how the transition region scales if you say, as we do find, that the transition region, the length scale of it is set by the separation of the wave vectors, kf up minus kf down. And when you do that, you basically find little l is the region of the size of the transition region going from the unpolarized superfluid to the fully polarized normal region outside. Okay? And so that's the condition for validity of... And so what you find is that when N alpha to the 1/3 is much greater than 1 for a fixed non-zero polarization, the Thomas Fermi approximation could get better and better. We actually don't know the coefficients in front of this. So if you just forget about the coefficients and just look at this, you can see that this is exactly what the Bogliubov-Degen shows. Okay, so... Here I said again, I talked about polarized fermions at unitarity in an asymmetric trap, and I said that you can see intermediate regions, I hate to call it a phase because it's not a bulk phase of matter, which is not present either in bulk or Thomas Fermi, and this leads to a violation of Thomas Fermi as the asymmetry increases, a restoration of Thomas Fermi as the total N increases. And that actually certainly gives a qualitative understanding of the differences. But I think the key question is how to probe this intermediate region if it's really there. Because if you see some new physics which you don't expect in the bulk, which the trap somehow stabilizes, how do we probe that? And I think that's actually is an open question.
So okay. That's a question.
Yes.
So when you do your calculation of delta and N, is the density allowed to relax, or do you have
yes. density is allowed to relax. I didn't show you. So the density is allowed to relax. The densities in Bogliubov-Degen and Thomas Fermi are separate. Yeah. Yes, Eric.
You showed a plot where you could see slightly more than one FFLO oscillation.
Yeah.
You arrange the parameters to get many FFLO
oscillations? Yes. So the way to arrange that is the following. I mean, at least if you just want to convince yourself of the correctness of this. Okay, because with this anisotropic trap, we are dealing with complicated special functions, so there's some limitation on the parameters that we can do. But if you just want to see this, you can do the following calculation. Just do a one-dimensional Bogle-Bobdingen calculation. Okay, and so if you say that at x equals negative infinity, you have a unpolarized superfluid, and over here you have a fully polarized normal, then just as boundary conditions, as it were, then you get to solve a one-dimensional problem, and then you really find a delta profile that looks like this. Okay, so Eric Mueller has also done similar calculations, but yeah, so that's a way to convince yourself that you can see more. Okay, but it may be that actually in a given trap for given parameters, you don't see many oscillations at all. You know, that's just a fact of life. Because it's just a small transition region, so it's doing something. You know, and it'll fit in as many
as... Perhaps in a quantity trap, and then suppose you add
some sure. On the other hand, if you make the trap very, very flat, this will go away. Because then I think this will be too costly a region even to fill in as a sliver. So I think it's a very delicate matter. Okay, yes.
Scaling with alpha.
Yes.
Shows that if you had a very anisotropic but oblate spheroid, then Thomas Fermi would be good.
No. I think it's only in this, yeah. Otherwise, you have to probably change it. I haven't thought about that, but we can sit down and think about it. Okay, I don't know if people have patience. This is a rather technical part of the talk, actually. This is the most technical part of the talk, but I don't know if people are tired, they can leave because it's 1 hour, so I think it's fair to say that. Okay, so here I want to talk about a completely different subject, quantum fluctuations in the superfluid state. So just to make sure, now I'm going to again revert back to equal spin populations. I'm going to talk about infinite volume, no trap. I'm going to talk about zero temperature, and I'm going to ask the kinds of questions that Eric was asking. Since all the previous calculations were wrong, can we understand how to make them righter, even if not right? Okay, because right means then you have to just simply do quantum Monte Carlo. And even that, I think you have to understand that the quantum Monte Carlo at zero temperature is a fixed node approximation, which is not an exact calculation. You just forcing the nodes of the wave function to be the BCS nodes, and then adding whatever other stuff you can through the diffusion Monte Carlo. But you're not allowing the nodes of the quantum many-body wave function to actually move. Okay, so it is not an... So there are no exact statements. Then you have to just go and do it in a lab. Okay, good. So the goal is to go beyond the Leggett BCS mean field theory. And what I'm going to do...
According to Eric, Newton's equation is also wrong, strictly speaking.
This is a case where there is a limit where you can solve it, where some exact solutions can be found.
Jason, I think you can have this discussion either in Columbus or on the beach, but not at my expense.
There is a well-defined problem.
Well, nobody knows the answer to it. I said that, yeah? Okay. So this, what I'm going to say, is similar to, but distinct from the 1 over n expansion with SP2 and fermions, okay? So as I learned long ago in graduate school, there are two ways to do calculations. One is to distort the problem and do an exact solution, which is what the large n story is. But another way is to not distort the problem and simply make approximations on the thing. And both have their virtues, okay? Although I think in these days where field theory is on the ascendance, this looks very exciting, SP2n and so on. But you have to remember that finally n is equal to 1. So everything that you've thrown out is at the same order, a numerical value, as what you kept. Maybe true, but not here. But here it's spin 1/2.
You have spin 3/2 for me.
No. So for some systems, it may be that it's a very good approximation. Here also, it gives you insights. Okay, it's a very good way to organize terms. But let me just, you'll see what the virtues of what I'm going to do, despite the fact that it's not 1 over n. Okay, and its limitations as well, which also you will see. Okay, so the mean field, Leggett BCS mean field theory is very well known, and in a functional integral approach, you can do it as a uniform static saddle point of the functional integral. But here are the limitations of the mean field theory. I'm not discussing mean field theory, everybody knows it. Okay, so I'll discuss. In the BCS limit, the mean field theory, as I described, just doing a uniform static saddle point, doesn't capture the Li-Yang, Galitsky, Abrikosov, Khalatnikov, I don't know who are the people or giants who did this, normal state interaction corrections to the ground state energy. Okay. Also, this kind of a saddle point approximation doesn't capture the Gorkov, Malik, Barkhadarov correction to the pre-exponential factor in the gap. These are two known limitations. Okay, fine. At unitarity, if you look at various numbers, such as the gap expressed as the only scale epsilon Fermi, or the chemical potential divided by epsilon Fermi, which is also the same as the ground state energy in units of the free Fermi gas ground state energy, okay, then mean field theory gives you numbers of 0.69 and 0.59, whereas if you do the fixed node quantum Monte Carlo, which is the best that we know how to do, the energy is considerably lower, and the gap is also slightly lower. Those are the numbers, so that's another limitation. And finally, there is the famous BEC limit, exact solution of Petrov et al., okay, that the mean field theory gives you 2 AS, whereas the exact solution of the four-body problem gives you 0.6 AS. So these are the limitations of mean field theory. And let us see which of these you can overcome by looking at physics beyond mean field theory in some kind of a systematic way. And I'll warn you that there are some things you will be able to attack and other things that you won't, and even things that you will be able to get, you won't get perfect agreement with the numbers that you get from numerics. But at least you want to understand what is the physics that lowers the energy. You know, what is lowering the energy beyond the mean field theory? Okay, so we'll do a self-consistent Gaussian theory, and this will include the quantum fluctuations of the following kind. It'll include the zero-point motion of the collective modes in the ground state wave function. We're not doing it in a wave function language, but you can think about it that way. And it will also include the effect of the virtual scattering of quasi-particles. And when you do that, you get at least some nice results. First is that you recover the Li-Yang and Galitsky theory, the interaction correction to the ground state energy in the BCS limit. So that's one known result recovered in the weak coupling limit. And secondly, you get some sense of the reduction of the ground state energy and the gap at unitarity, but that comes at a price, as you will see. Okay, so this is kind of technical at this stage, but those who know it will be able to follow it, okay? So you look at the Hubbard-Sultanovich field delta, which is depends on space and time. That's what this is, a four vector. You take out the space-time independent piece, delta naught, and look at all fluctuations around it, and these are in some Cartesian basis. That's why I call them Cartesian fluctuations, okay? And then you can integrate out these fluctuations, so you get a mean field-like action, okay, which is sort of well known from BCS theory, plus the stuff that you get from here, which gives you there. Okay, so this is the yes. Okay, so it just means this.
Philosophical meaning or coordinates-like.
Coordinates-like. It's not Cartesian in the philosophical sense. It's Cartesian in the sense of x and y, because very soon you'll see polar in the sense of r and theta. Yes. Right. Oh, you were worried whether I was going to say, you know, I compute, therefore I am, or something like that. Yes. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Integrated out fermions, right?
Yes. So first I integrate out the fermions, okay? Then I integrate out even the Gaussian fluctuations around the saddle point. Okay, so here's what I get. Okay, very good. And this is the sort of inverse fluctuation propagator, which you can write down in well-known ways and so on. So at least hopefully you see what's going on. So once you integrate out that, the thermodynamic potential per unit volume is just given by this form. This is a sort of mean field-like term, plus this is the fluctuation contribution. You get log determinant from the bosonic fluctuations. Okay, now the first thing is this is a complete mess, and these integrals involved here are divergent. And the divergence is not something which is just related to the two-body problem in vacuum. If it were, you could regularize it in the usual way. And actually, you have to put something called convergence factors. So I don't know, it's a technical point, but I think it's kind of important here. It's basically that in the operator formulation, in when you write down a thermodynamic potential, you have to take the equal time limit of certain correlation functions. And how you take that equal time limit, whether you take tau going to 0 plus or 0 minus, is important and delicate, and you have to handle it. And so when you do it right, actually you get not just the log of the determinant, but you get log of M22 divided by M11 determinant with this convergence factor. Okay? So that's an important technical point. Now what do you do? Now that you have a finite expression for the thermodynamic potential, you find a new saddle point which includes the feedback from the fluctuations, because this is a function of delta, this is a function of delta, this is a Nambu-Gorka propagator, and this mess is also a function of the delta naught. So you say that you want to minimize omega with respect to delta naught, and you want to impose a number equation. Yes, please.
Would you refer to as convergence factors? Is it this ratio of M's and E to the IQ? Are they both,
both
convergence factors?
That's right. It's the act of putting in convergence factors that gives you this.
Are they factors that are inserted in order to get remove divergences, or are they required regardless?
They are. So how best to put it? They are actually regarded, they are required regardless. It's just that they don't come out in an automated way when you do it in the functional integral language. If you were doing it in an operator language, you would never have, you would have gotten this, except it would have been a mess to get. Maybe
so
I can...
So if you had put in an ultraviolet cutoff...
It would not have...
...and still have had to insert those factors anyway to...
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. Maybe a simple example might be useful, and maybe I can just give you a simple example later. Okay, for want of time, I'm not going to do that. Okay. Okay, now, of course, it's wonderful to do all the calculation on the Matsubara axis as we do, but it's very hard to get any physical intuition on the Matsubara axis. So when you go to the real axis where you're not doing the calculation, what you find is that omega can be written like this, okay? This omega naught is sort of the mean field-like contribution. Then you really get zero-point motion of the collective excitations, which are this, okay? Plus you get the continuum contribution, okay? That's coming from virtual scattering of quasi-particles. But the stuff that you got out of the convergence factors is also sitting in there, and its zero-point motion and contribution to the continuum is also important, and you have to deal with that, okay? And we can talk about how to interpret that. Okay.
Are you going to say how to interpret?
Yeah, I... not right now, because I think I would like to finish in 10 minutes.
But that was the most interesting bit.
Yeah, well, you'll see. So let's try and get some sense of what... So let's first look at the BCS limit. Here you find that the continuum completely dominates the poles, and you can just expand out everything in sight and just show that there's a one-to-one correspondence with the diagrams of Li, Yang, and Galitsky. And so you get this famous result of theirs. So that the ground state energy is 3 epsilon Fermi over 5 that you would have gotten without anything, minus the delta square over epsilon Fermi, that's the BCS condensation energy. And what all this continuum stuff got you is these two terms. Okay, so it comes out, and...
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, those are very, very... Those are year-long calculations.
This is correct.
They
come out in... Actually, Li and Yang is very complicated, and I don't understand. Galitsky's can... At least, after the fact can be done rather more simply.
The integrals are just hard.
This is true. Very the hard. Integrals are hard. If you want to do 11 minus 2 log. This is true.
But they did the same integral anyway.
But they did it. I mean, yeah, you're right.
I'm impressed.
Okay, so it comes out. So that's at least a step in the right direction.
I mean, this Green's function is yes. Mean field Green's function, is it? It's not exact Green's function.
Indeed. In fact, it's worse than the, I mean, it's even simpler than the field Green's function. Actually, you can set delta naught equal to 0 in order to evaluate these corrections in the extreme BCS limit. Because they are somehow normal state corrections to the ground state energy. You see, if there had been no superconductivity, that's what Li Yang and Galitsky were talking about. But
so there's no corrections to the BCS type
contribution. So the Gorkov Malik Barkhudarov correction does not come out of these calculations. And you can see that diagrammatically as to why it doesn't come out. Because the Gorkov-Malik-Barkhudarov correction comes from saying that the irreducible vertex that you will use for pairing is this guy. So this kind of cross diagrams are just not there when you do this, Gaussian fluctuations around mean field theory. Okay, but Li Yang Galitsky is there. Then you can march on towards unitarity. And here, both pole and continuum excitations, both are important. So this was the old mean field result. This was the quantum Monte Carlo result. You can just calculate what delta and mu are. And you get these numbers. And you can be very happy and go home. But there is a very serious problem. Okay, and that's the however. The serious problem is you found a new saddle point. Right? And you have to ask, what is the spectrum of collective excitations around the saddle point? And the answer is that Goldstone's theorem is violated. Okay? So even though your numbers look good, when you find this new saddle point, the spectrum of collective excitations is looking very bad.
What's the origin of violation?
Yeah, so here is the...
Are you saying it's not a conserving approximation?
Yeah, it's not a conserving approximation. I don't know whether... Okay, I'm saying what I'm saying, that Goldstone's theorem is violated.
Well, it's not a conserving approximation.
Fine. Actually, it's not true, because Zwerger and company did what at least they claimed was a conserving approximation, and they found the same problem. I think this is a generic problem. Now, I'm going to give you a very technical reason why Goldstone's theorem is violated. I don't know if that's good enough, but that's all I have. Then I'll give you a physical hand-waving reason also. But first, the technical reason is that if you look at the propagator, the masslessness of the Goldstone mode is basically equivalent to satisfying the mean field gap equation. As soon as you move away from the mean field saddle point by adding this Gaussian term, you find that this is no longer equal to that, because now this one also enters into the picture and Goldstone's theorem is violated. Okay, I think a physical way to say this is the following. And that, next slide is the physical way to say it, so I come back to that. So what do previous authors say about this? Well, either they simply ignore this problem, because if you do the calculation, the Matsubara axis, you don't even realize that you violated Goldstone's theorem. You know, you just do a calculation, you get some numbers, you're happy, you compare with quantum Monte Carlo and live happily ever afterwards. Or Zwerger, Hausmann and company did this kind of Kadanoff-Bame conserving approximation. They found this problem. What they did was they said they will monkey around with the scattering length. This is going to be some number at unitarity, you know. They'll just put it in here and say we'll fiddle with the... They're very, at least very honest and very truthful about it. They say this is what we do because this is the only way we can make Goldstone's theorem satisfied. You can just say that I have a new scattering length, which is shifted from the old scattering length. But that's a very unpleasant thing to do, in my opinion. Okay? But they say it, that we have this problem, we'll solve it this way. Or there are other groups that say, we will insist that this term doesn't exist, you know, for one reason. We'll just pretend that the gap equation is always the mean field gap equation and say everything is in... All the differences are in the number equation, which is a piece of physics that's was justifiable and worked in the calculation around TC, Nozieres and Schmidt-Rink. But here, it's not justifiable. The term that you're dropping is just as big as the terms you're keeping. In fact, it's an internally inconsistent assumption to say this. Okay? So what should we do? Yes?
You are using the Cartesian coordinates.
Yeah, so thank you. You're one step ahead of me. Okay? So the solution is the Goldstone mode is associated with phase fluctuations. So why don't you switch to polar representation? I think the reason why people use Cartesian coordinates is because back in the 1990s, we used Cartesian coordinate, and everybody then used Cartesian coordinates after us. Okay? The calculation is easier in Cartesian coordinates. Okay, but if you switch to the polar representation, it's wonderful. Okay? The Goldstone theorem is recovered. And the reason, I think it's too late for me to give you a hand-waving reason on the blackboard, but ask me, and I can give you a two-minute answer on the blackboard, why technically also, you don't need to satisfy the some gap equation-like constraint in order to impose the masslessness of the theta field if you do this calculation. So you're very happy. Let's go and do the calculation this way. But there is still another wrinkle to the story, okay? So the problem is neither representation of Gaussian fluctuation works for all Q and omega. Because what you find is that insofar as the low energy behavior is concerned, the Cartesian fluctuations are very bad. They violate Goldstone. And the polar are very good. But insofar as the high energy behavior is concerned, the Cartesian representation is very good and the polar one is terrible. And there is a good physical reason for this mathematical problem, that if you want to look at low energy long wavelength fluctuations about a broken symmetry phase, then Cartesian is bad and polar is the natural thing to do, phase and amplitude. But if you want to look at very high energy, short distance fluctuations around the broken symmetry state, you don't care about the broken symmetry, right? And therefore, the natural basis is not the Cartesian one. The natural representation is the Cartesian one, right? It's not amplitude and phase, right? If you were to actually do a calculation in the non-broken symmetry state, the way you would do fluctuations is precisely using Cartesian. So that's why that has the good high energy behavior. So you have a very unfortunate situation, okay?
So you just cannot proceed with the calculation.
So you cannot proceed with the calculation. You cannot make the answers convergent. And this has nothing to do with the problems of the two-body problem in vacuum. Now, you could say, and with some justification, that who told you that you should be allowed to take a Gaussian calculation to arbitrarily high energies? The whole calculation makes no sense. You should just do it at low energies, okay? But the funny thing is, in the Cartesian coordinates, it is convergent and it's not dominated by high energy physics. So therefore, it's a very natural way to do that calculation there. Anyway, so then you have to find a fix. And so one thing that you can do is to interpolate between the polar, which has nice properties at low energies, and the Cartesian, which has nice properties at high energies. And on what scale do you interpolate? Well, at unitarity, there's only one scale, epsilon Fermi in energy, or KF in momentum, okay? And if you do that, well, then these are the answers for whatever they are worth. But at least, so this is delta, this is the chemical potential of the ground state energy, but at least this has a nice speed of sound, which is sound
how,
is still...
How do you impose
there's no... So what we do is we do a interpolation.
Oh, I see.
Where the low energy physics is that described by the polar, the high energy physics is that described by Cartesian, and you interpolate on the scale of the only scale at unitarity.
So your bottom line there was polar plus...
That's right. That's right. So in fact, the bottom line should not said polar, it should have said, you're absolutely right, Eric, polar plus Cartesian, interpolate. Okay, so that's the conclusions of part three, and I think now I don't want to put you in the... I've only kept it to the Gaussian regime. I won't take you to the nonlinear regime by taking more time.
Victor. Not so much as a question,
but more I can make a statement.
Sure, please.
At some point you said that we made progress understanding what's going on in the BEC regime. Well, I think not only we made progress, we actually solved the problem in the BEC regime. So I know exactly what happens in the BEC regime.
Oh, sorry. I agree with you.
Yes, but then I would add the following. Because of that, I know exactly what you need to do to solve the problem in the BEC regime. And for example, I can compare mean fields to the correct solution, and I can also compare this self-consistent RPA to the exact solution. And as far as I can see, both of them neglect infinite number of diagrams, which are all of the same order.
Yes.
Which means that if we're after numbers at unitary regime, we'd like to calculate some number. We're making as bad an error doing mean field as we're doing by doing self-consistent RPA. So I can't really see why one of them should be better than the other.
So
BEC regime, both of them make the same type of error.
This is true. I agree. I agree with your statement that both of them make the same kind of error in the BEC regime. I didn't talk anything about the BEC regime here because I am aware of that. What I feel is, okay, one's first goal at the mean field level was, do you find some approximation that gives reasonable answers in the two limits? Then maybe you can get some trust in between. Okay? Now at least what I'm trying to... We started this, we said, well, can we at least go from the BCS regime, which after all, since you are working with a fermionic theory, you'd better capture as much physics in the BCS regime as possible and try to push it towards unitarity. But I agree with you, there is no small parameter at unitarity. But the advantage of this is that it at least captures BCS physics, you know, beyond simple BCS theory, and tries to push and see how much of the physics you can understand at unitarity. But there is no small parameter. So if you think in terms of diagrams, I agree with you. Yeah.
I could ask a slightly philosophical question that goes back to the start of your talk, which was when you were saying you were interested in looking for things which had some interesting feature at unitarity.
Yes.
I mean, one striking thing about the unitarity point, particularly in a limit where the density of the particles gets very low, is the Peer wave function has a rather characteristic form at short distances. There's a 1 over R thing.
Yes.
Are there experiments that would reveal that or weight that in some particular way?
So I don't know the answer to that, but perhaps others do here.
I don't understand the question.
Are there experiments that probe the internal pair wave function at unitarity or indeed anywhere else?
Well, I guess you look at the momentum distribution, obviously does, but...
No, the momentum distribution is very smooth and boring through unitarity. I don't think it's very obvious how to...
To do the thing that you want to do...
Well, no, I'm not suggesting anything specific, Jason. What I'm asking is, are there experiments that are particularly sensitive
I don't
to
know.
The form of the Peer wave function? And the answer may be no.
Are there experiments that are sensitive to the supercurrent density?
I think that there are proposals for that. So this guy Raman at Georgia Tech has proposed that he can use Bragg scattering to... image flows. So I think that will happen. And insofar as critical velocity measurements, there are actually at least two published papers by the MIT group measuring critical velocities in the bosonic BEC. So I think, again, in principle, there's no reason why critical velocities cannot be measured in the lab for the fermionic system.
Problem with measuring critical velocities is you almost never measure, quote, intrinsic critical velocities. The only experiment I know at helium-3 is an old experiment at Clintock, where usually you measure things that are associated with vortex formation and boundaries. And the only experiment that's really essentially intrinsic is high energy ions, which actually measure the Landau critical velocity for rotons. And the pressure dependence actually comes out right. Delta depends on pressure. So by varying the pressure, you get a shift in VC, and that comes out pretty well. But that's, most other experiments in helium certainly always see a critical velocity which is at least a small fraction and often an order of magnitude less than the Landau critical velocity.
That's indeed correct. In fact, very often orders of magnitude different.
And I presume you'd be have the same kinds of problems because Ketterly's experiment was in a finite condensate, and presumably boundary effects come in there. The critical velocity was less than the value that was predicted, but I guess it was a factor of 2 or 3, not 10.
So you're absolutely right. Even in helium 4, you know, most experiments are some vortex loop blowout, which is rather than you know, spewing out rotons a la Landau, which is responsible for.
I mean, it's kind of a miracle that there are any experiments that measure these, and Peter McClintock spent years doing them, and they're in a very obscure journal. I just actually saw the reference in something that Tony had written.
But I suspect that the measurement of the flow can perhaps be done here, and see that. That's a criteria for a critical velocity.
But you want to actually image the flow around a single vortex.
For instance, I don't know if it's possible, but maybe it's possible.
If you write, I was going to ask this privately, but since we're on this, if you write J, the supercurrent, as rho times V.
Yes.
And the V doesn't, it has 1 over R dependence, right. But the coefficient is just H over M or M star.
Right.
Then, in a sense, it's the maximum critical velocity is at least partly a measure of the maximum in rho s.
This is true.
But it also depends on where you reach the critical velocity. So it's a little more complicated than just
it
rho
is.
S.
It is. But I think the thing I wanted to say was that the non-monotonic behavior seems to be a fact of life here, whether you look at the Landau criterion or whether you look at the structure of flows around a vortex. And a maximum at unitarity.
And it's certainly related to the fact that the psi GL has a minimum.
It is indeed, because you can say that the critical velocity is H. But
that's that. From your arguments, that's easy to understand, the two limits.
That's
it has
right.
To have a minimum.
That's
somewhere.
Right. You could say just by dimensional analysis, H bar over M psi is the critical velocity. And so if psi has a minimum, then the critical velocity, okay. So that's a third way to think about it, actually. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, in helium, I like to think of it as a place where, even in the dilute closed gas, as a place where it goes supersonic. And then you can think of the vortex cores forming by cavitation.
I see. Okay. I understand what you said.
Classical compressed fluid,
yes.
You have automatically a hole when the fluid starts to go supersonic,
yes.
Because you get to the Bernoulli pressure, goes bizarre.
I understand.
And so that's another way of thinking about it.
That's right. That's another way to think about it.
So I mean, I guess I'm a bit surprised that this self-conscious Gaussian actually not getting the gapless mode.
Okay. So
can I just ask a question specifically? So if I think back about what, for instance, Maria did for the magnetic systems,
right.
I think the spin waves are correctly captured. The formalism seems very similar. Now, what I'm trying to think is that suppose I'm doing XY magnet.
Yes.
That's supposed to be SU2. What would happen? The answer is not obvious. But
so we can look at that. I mean, I would very much like to look into that.
Yeah.
So later on the
just
week.
Take an actual
let's do that. Yeah. That. Okay. But in this formalism, you know, the at least in the Cartesian basis, what enforces Goldstone is the mean field gap equation. Any deviation from the mean field gap equation and you're dead. It's just a mathematical statement.
But I think if you compute Green's functions, also going beyond the field the same way how you went beyond the field here, you will get gapless Green's functions. You have no choice because in the end you have Goldstone boson.
So you're saying that the Green's function that entered this should also be renormalized back so as to... Okay, I don't know of a simple way to do that. I mean, is there a simple way to do that?
Maybe some large...
I can do it in the
just for weakly interacting those gases, like an exercise you can do and see how this works.
So you want him to modify the procedure of integrating out the fermions?
Yeah, in a sense. That's right. That's what I would have to do. I would have to modify that procedures. I don't know how to do that. But okay, I'd be happy to.
I still find the Hooking Pulse Binds procedure is the best way to compute Green's function as opposed to expanding path integral and Gaussian fluctuations. I would switch lots of stuff under the rug. And in this first procedure, you just see that the Green's functions always remain the outlets while the constant density gets normalized.
So if I knew how to generalize Hugenholz spines out of the extreme BEC limits towards unitarity, I would be delighted. See, the problem here is that there's all this beautiful work that you've done which works in the BEC limit. We don't know how to pull it towards unitarity. I would be even happy if it didn't go all the way to BCS, but at least you had an overlapping formalism. You know, this one starts from BCS and at least gives semi-sensible results at unitarity. I would be happy if there was a Bose limit formulation which could at least come to unitarity, but none of the Bose limit formulations that I know are able to approach unitarity also. They break down. So that's why I think it's worthwhile exploring these things to see how to devise something. That's all.
Sure, but at least you can see the origin of this violation Goldstone theorem on the example of the
Yes, Kanchan.
In the randomness area, the simple free is most stronger in the randomness area.
Yes.
So if for charge the simple free, is there clear statements here correct? In that case, this the formal mode is gone, is by the
I haven't thought about that. It's a good question you're asking me. What determines the critical velocity in a charged superfluid, if you were to do this?
What is the resonance?
No, so he's just saying, okay, just take some model. He's just asking a hypothetical question. Suppose these things had charge, then you would have pushed the phonon mode up to the plasmon. Now, what will be the fate of? I understand. That's why I haven't thought about it. Yeah, it's a completely different problem. But he's asking. Okay. Thank you very much.